Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 2, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to welcome with us today Mr. Paul J. Beard, who's a principal attorney at the National Litigation Center for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Mr. Beard has been involved in the case that we're going to be discussing today. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 10 minutes, talking about the background on the case, sketching out the facts a little bit, maybe where the case was procedurally, then talking about the decision and the implications going forward in this important property rights case. And with that, Mr. Beard, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean. So this case actually has a very long history, and the legal background is even longer than that, actually. It starts really with a 1987 decision of the United States Supreme Court in Nolan versus California Coastal Commission, which was another case, actually, that PLF argued before the court. And in that case, the Supreme Court, in essence, set down a very strict constitutional standard for certain kinds of permit exactions imposed on property owners who wanted to use or develop their properties. The Nolan case involved a family that wanted, in essence, to replace a 500-square-foot bungalow with a larger single-family home along the coast of California in Ventura County, and they applied to the land use state agency responsible for issuing permits, the California Coastal Commission, and the Coastal Commission approved their project, but on the condition that they give up a public access easement along the backside, the beachfront side of their property, which was private. And the Nolans rightfully asked themselves, what does this public access easement requirement have anything to do with what we're trying to do with our property? All of their neighbors had already built similarly sized single-family homes. It was perfectly legal under relevant zoning laws and regulations. And the Nolans saw no reason why they would have to give up such a valuable interest in their real estate in exchange for the right to build. And they challenged the Coastal Commission's condition in the state courts. The matter went all the way up to this United States Supreme Court, and the question there was, was this easement requirement in violation of the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution? Because certainly the Coastal Commission could not have unilaterally knocked on the Nolans' door one day and said, we want an easement across your property, but we don't want to have to pay for it. They would have been in violation of the takings clause. So the question was, does it make a difference if this occurs within the permitting process, where the government, in this case the Coastal Commission, has tremendous leverage against the property owner? And the United States Supreme Court said, no, there is no difference. The Coastal Commission, state agencies and local agencies in the permitting process can't do indirectly via the permitting process what it's prohibited from doing in directly via, say, eminent domain. And so the Supreme Court struck the condition, declared it unconstitutional, and actually described it as, quote, an out-and-out plan of extortion by the Coastal Commission against the Nolan family. The court based its holding in that case on a doctrine, the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, which in essence says that you cannot be made to give up a constitutional right in exchange for a benefit, like a land use permit. And that was precisely what the court saw was happening here, that the Coastal Commission was burdening the Nolans' right to just compensation for a taking of an easement by forcing them to relinquish it in exchange for a permit, and that violated the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, which in the past has been applied to First Amendment type cases and other types of cases, but never really in the context of the Fifth Amendment takings clause. This was, I believe, the first case in which the court applied the doctrine in the context of the takings clause. So in rendering a decision in Nolan, the court laid down a very tough standard that governments have to meet when they impose exactions. The court said that any exaction of an interest in real estate must satisfy the following standards. The government must show that there is an essential nexus, a close relationship between what's being demanded, in this case an easement, and the impact of the project. So, for example, had the Nolans project in some way undermined or eliminated existing public access, then the commission would have been within its rights to ask for a public access easement somewhere else on the property in order to mitigate against that loss. But because here all we had was an upgrade of a home that had no impact on existing public access, the commission's demand for an easement really bore no connection to the impact of what the Nolans were trying to do. And this was a very important test that land use agencies had to comply with over the next 25, 26 years. In a subsequent decision in 1994, Dolan versus City of Tigard, the court refined its test and said not only does there have to be a close connection, but it has to be roughly proportional as well. And that was an important gloss to the Nolan test. And now these tests are combined, known as the Nolan-Dolan tests that land use agencies have to meet. The problem over the last 26 years, since Nolan in particular was decided, was that land use agencies cleverly began to try to skirt this very heightened scrutiny under the takings clause that the court had laid out. And it did so in two ways relevant to our decision that came down last week. Number one, some jurisdictions, some land use permitting agencies began, instead of approving projects with conditions, they instead began to deny projects when the property owner refused to first agree to conditions. And so you had a dichotomy, really, of the way in which land use permitting decisions were made. For example, in the case of Nolan and in Dolan, the government agency simply approved a permit and listed the conditions that had to be satisfied before building permits could actually issue. Some jurisdictions, like in the Koontz case, which I'll talk about in a moment, land use permit agency would approach the property owner either behind closed doors or at the hearing for the permit and say, look, we won't approve your permit unless you first agree to submit to our conditions. The problem with this scenario is that in many jurisdictions, including Florida, where the Koontz case originates, once you accept the condition, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to later challenge it. So property owners were really put in a sort of a catch-22 with this sort of a scenario. They had to first accept the condition and waive their right to challenge it, and then they'd get approval, never being able to challenge the condition. And this was a way in which many agencies began to insulate their conditions. They pointed to the Nolan case, they pointed to the Dolan case, and said, there you had permit approvals with conditions. That's quite different from a permit denial that results from refusal to submit to a condition. And so they saw a constitutional significance in the difference between those types of permit actions, saying that Nolan and Dolan did not apply to permit denials. The second way, perhaps the more pernicious way, in which land use agencies began to skirt Nolan and Dolan was by replacing demands for interests in real property, like an easement, with monetary and fee exactions and other kinds of exactions, really, that had nothing to do with interests in real property. So we've seen an explosion over the last several decades in so-called in-lieu fees, fees in lieu of dedicating property, or in monetary exactions and other types of financial obligations imposed on property owners who are applying for a permit. And what the government has been doing here across the country, local, state, and federal, is to, in essence, require permit applicants to pay for public projects having nothing whatsoever to do with the impact of what they're trying to do on their land. And this has been a way, quite frankly, for local government agencies to, in essence, avoid having to impose unpopular taxes on their constituents when a public project benefits the entire community. They find it much easier to target individual permit applicants and force them to pay for public projects that in reality the entire community should be paying for. And the argument that the land use permitting agencies made in this regard was to say that, look, Nolan and Dolan should be applied strictly to the facts of those cases. Those cases involve demands for an easement or demands for land. we're not talking about that when we're imposing monetary exactions. And so therefore, the heightened scrutiny required under Nolan and Dolan to show a close connection and rough proportionality, those tests don't apply when all we're doing is imposing a financial obligation on property owners. Those kinds of exactions, land use permitting agencies were arguing, should be subject to a more deferential standard of review, not the Nolan-Dolan heightened scrutiny standard. And so we've been trying over the last several years to get these two issues before the United States Supreme Court via numerous cases. And finally, they accepted the issues in Koontz versus St. John's River Water Management District in October of last year. And the background facts of those of this case is really remarkable. A property owner, Coy Koontz Sr., purchased a 15-acre lot in a fully developed area of Orlando, Florida. He wanted to develop only 3.7 acres of that 15-acre lot, and it was on the portion of the property that abutted a major highway. And everything in the area was developed with commercial properties like a liquor store, gas station, and the like. So there really shouldn't have been an issue with his developing these 3.7 acres. But because over the years, Florida began to regulate more strictly for wetland impacts, his lot and the surrounding area actually was placed in what is called an environmentally sensitive area. It was considered designated to be wetlands. Now, what this designation meant was not that there were actually wetlands on Mr. Koontz's property, but that there was a presumption that there was, and that he had to rebut that presumption in the permitting process. So because his property lay within a wetlands designated area, he went to the state agency responsible for issuing wetland permits, applied for a permit to develop 3.7 acres, and the district, St. John's River Water Management District, made a demand. It said, you first have to dedicate the remaining 11 or so acres into a conservation easement. To this, Mr. Koontz reluctantly agreed. He didn't want to fight it. He realized that his 3.7-acre building pad didn't have wetlands or endangered species that were supported by wetlands, but he didn't want to spend the time or the money to fight the conservation easement requirement, and so he reluctantly agreed. The night before the hearing on his permit, though, district staff called him and said, well, we want something more. We want you also to pay for public improvements on our land located miles and miles away. We want you to plug some ditches, replace some canals, build a road, all to the tune of approximately $150,000. And Mr. Koontz, by this point, was really frustrated because he realized, again, that the small area that he wanted to develop did not actually impact any wetlands. And so, first of all, there was no reason to ask for the conservation easement, but he agreed to that in order to move the process along. But he certainly couldn't see why he'd also have to pay for $150,000 worth of improvements on government-owned land located miles and miles away, given that he was impacting minimal to no wetlands from his project. And so at the hearing, he was again asked by the district, we want to adopt our staff's recommendation that you also perform off-site mitigation. Will you do so? And Mr. Koontz said, I absolutely cannot because the project does not pencil out if I have to spend that kind of money. Mr. Koontz was not a big-time developer. He was a very small property owner, business owner, who was using this land, this lot, as his retirement nest egg, and he just simply wanted entitlements so that he could sell the land and retire with some money. He did not have the money to spend $150,000 for improvements, so he said no. And at that point, the district denied his permit. When the district denied his permit, Mr. Koontz sued in the Florida state court system under Nolan and Dolan. He argued that the condition, the exaction of off-site mitigation, this requirement that he spend money for a public project having nothing to do with the impact of his development, was unconstitutional under the Nolan and Dolan tests because there was no connection. The Florida trial court accepted various expert testimony to that buttressed the point that there was no wetlands on his building pad. The district was unable to come up with a single expert to the contrary. Ultimately, after he won in the trial court and in the Court of Appeal of Florida, the district finally recognized that in reality, there was nothing for him to mitigate, and they issued him his permit without the offending exaction. But the trial court awarded Mr. Kuntz damages of over $300,000 under a state statute that says that damages are awardable when the government violates the rights of individuals. And in essence, the court found that they had temporarily taken his property because they had imposed this unconstitutional exaction for several years without allowing him to develop. And so he obtained a damages award and a permit without the offending exaction. Upset, obviously, that they would have to pay damages, the district appealed the Florida Court of Appeal decision to the Florida Supreme Court, hoping to get the Nolan Dolan issue reversed, and they were successful. Florida Supreme Court said, Nolan and Dolan don't apply where, number one, you have a permit, you have a condition that results in a permit denial, and number two, where the exaction is for money as opposed to land. At that point, Pacific Legal Foundation, which had participated as amicus, took the case up to the United States Supreme Court. We argued it in January, and just last week on Tuesday, we received a 5-4 decision written by Justice Alito, who for the majority said that there is no constitutional difference between a condition that results in a permit denial and a condition attached to a permit approval. In both cases, you have an act of extortion that is subject to heightened scrutiny under Nolan and Dolan. Interestingly enough, all 9 justices agreed on this point. Even the dissent agreed that there is no difference between conditions precedent to permit approval and conditions subsequent to permit approval. So on that point, we won really unanimously. The court split on the second point about money exactions. A majority found that money exaction, that money, financial obligations imposed in the permitting process are protected under the Takings Clause and are subject to Nolan and Dolan review. It's no different than a demand for land or a demand for an interest in real estate. And on this point, of course, the dissent disagreed and worries that the court's decision will simply open up the courthouse doors to all sorts of litigation challenging taxes and fees and other such monetary obligations occurring outside the permit process. So the dissent really had sort of the sky will fall type of an argument that land use regulation will be put to an end and that all sorts of challenges will be made to taxes, fees, and other kinds of monetary obligations. So we had a clean sweep victory on both issues. What this means now for property owners is that Nolan, the protections of Nolan and Dolan, now extend virtually to all permit exactions. It's really difficult to imagine a situation in which a permit exaction will not be subject to Nolan and Dolan review, requiring the government to show the necessary connection and proportionality between what they're demanding in property and the impact of an individual project. So it's a really excellent win for property owners across the country. The case now will go back to the Florida courts on remand on a couple of state procedural issues, and that remains to be seen what will happen in the state courts in the state Supreme Court. But as far as the federal issues are concerned, we really did have a wonderful victory last Tuesday that is sure to protect property owners in every state, in every jurisdiction against government extortion in the permitting process. That concludes my comments, and if there are any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Well, thank you very much. This is Dean Reuter again. We're speaking with Paul Beard about the Kuntz case. If you've joined us late, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Let's now open the floor to questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Mr. Beard, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Mr. Paul Beard, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll take questions in the order they're received. With that, let's go to our first caller.
Well, this is John Rowland, Constitution.org, and I'd like to congratulate Paul Beard for his wonderful victory. Now, however, we have a problem of where of going forward. And I am generally aware of a lot of cases similar to this across the country. I don't know how many are actually currently at issue, but there have certainly been a great many of them. And I'm not sure that most people who might be get relief under this precedent would know about them. So what is it going to take to propagate this win to practices across the country?
Do you mean in terms of publicizing the decision and the impact and the protections that property owners now have?
Well, yeah, particularly among the legal community, to let their potential clients know that, you know, of this precedent that may provide relief in their cases.
Well, we have been participating in a number of conferences for land use attorneys across the country that will most certainly let land use attorneys who specialize in this area know about the decision. Number two, the case has already gotten quite a surprising bit of publicity in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, a host of local papers like the Sacramento Bee and the Fresno Bee out here, and I'm sure in other states as well. So it has been getting a lot of play, and I think our job at Pacific Legal will be to continue to publicize as much as possible through forums, through conferences with land use attorneys, the importance of this case and the significance of the case to property owners who are facing monetary exactions. Because as I intimated earlier, monetary exactions and other kinds of financial obligations really have replaced almost entirely demands for interest in real property up until now, simply because that was a way for many agencies to skirt Nolan and Dolan. It'll be interesting to see how jurisdictions now they accommodate the decision that came down last week. After Nolan came down, many permitting agencies saw it as an excellent guidepost for them, and they ultimately were satisfied with the decision because it provided guidance. And I hope the same results from the Coons case, that now all permit conditions will have to go through this rigorous review by the agencies in the first case, because they have to now prove the connection. But then if it goes to court, they'll have to make their case in court too. And I think that provides important guidance for everyone. So it's very possible that many agencies will find this to be a good thing, and because it provides, again, guidance as to what the standard of review is, and will themselves propagate and accommodate the decisions on behalf of property owners.
All right, let's go to another question.
Hello, Paul. This is Arthur Hellman. My impression, which might be wrong, is that in the immediate wake of Nolan and Dolan, many state courts were rather hostile to those decisions and really didn't enforce them, and the Supreme Court didn't take the cert petitions that were raised. What do you anticipate is going to happen in the state courts now if that same attitude prevails?
Well, I think most of the hostility that state courts with which state courts reacted to the Nolan and Dolan cases stemmed out of this question whether how far they applied. And so many jurisdictions took the route that, look, Nolan and Dolan should be strictly applied to the facts of those cases, so not to monetary exactions, for example. Other jurisdictions said, no, the underlying rationale of Nolan and Dolan requires that they be applied across the board to all permit exactions, because extortion is extortion, coercion is coercion, and it makes no difference what form the exaction takes. So I think that now that we have the Coons decision, there's not much room, I don't believe, for jurisdictions to take the case, for state courts to take this case and try to carve out exceptions or try to narrowly apply it. There's really nothing to apply narrowly, because the court was quite sweeping both in its holding and in its rationale, the basis for its decision, as to why all forms of permit exaction need to be subject to this heightened scrutiny. So I don't foresee the same kind of they may not like the decision, but I don't see the same kind of attempts to carve out exceptions or to narrowly apply the decision as we saw with Nolan and Dolan. I think one of the great things about Coons is that it really cuts off the ability of state courts and land use permitting agencies to make excuses for exactions and not apply the appropriate constitutional scrutiny to them. So I don't suspect we're going to see much of much in the way of narrow application or exceptions to Kuntz, like we saw with Nolan and Dolan.
Thank you. That's encouraging.
We've got a couple callers lined up with questions. If you want to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, Paul. It's Damian Schiff. I wanted to know what you think about whether land use agencies can get around Kuntz by simply not offering an in-lieu fee option, that they simply impose the obligation that the applicant contribute its labor or somehow authorize the work to get done, but don't necessarily permit the applicant to get around the obligation by providing a monetary contribution.
Mr. Schiff, that's an excellent question, and I think the answer is that Kuntz provides a broad enough rationale for us at least to attempt to argue that even contributions of one's personal labor or other such arrangement would fall within the Nolan-Dolan standard of review. The court, actually the majority, the entire court, all nine justices, seemed to agree that if you can point to a specific property or a specific property right then that's trying to be taken by the government, then the Nolan-Dolan standard could apply. And so we would have to argue that your labor is your property, that you have a specific property interest in your time and in your labor. And if you can demonstrate that under state law, presumably, then that interest is sufficiently protected so that if the government tried to take it in the course of the permitting process, it would be subject to the Nolan-Dolan standard review. Well, why are you requiring this individual to dedicate his time in which he has a property interest, when it has no bearing whatsoever on the impact of the project that he's trying to perform on his property? So I think there is enough room in Kuntz to extend the analysis and the holding all the way to labor, to dedications of your time, and other kinds of non-monetary contributions. And we certainly at Pacific Legal Foundation will be looking forward to pressing that argument in the courts.
Let's take another caller. Let me ask you, Paul, as we're taking the next question, you've had a great string of successes at PLF. What's next? Do you have anything in the pipeline, anything headed to the court, anything accepted for next term?
We don't currently have any petitions, I don't believe, pending before the Supreme Court in a direct representation capacity. I may be wrong about that, but none of them comes to mind. So we don't have anything in the works right now before the Supreme Court, but you know, every year we're filing maybe half a dozen petitions for cert, mostly on property rights issues and on affirmative action issues before the United States
right.
Supreme Court. So it remains to be seen what happens next term.
All right, let's take another question.
Hi, Paul. This is Richard Tren. Congratulations. Can you give an idea of what other implications this might have for other regulatory takings?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure what the extent would be of this case's application to other kinds of regulatory takings, and I'm not sure exactly what you – maybe you can clarify your question before I ask. Are you contemplating a certain kind of regulatory taking in particular?
No, I'm not. I'm just wondering, you know, if this the minority warned about basically opening a can of worms. I'm just wondering how far this could be taken.
Got you. Right. No, the dissent argued that the rationale of this decision could, in theory, apply to challenges that occur outside the land use permitting process. And, for example, that we could possibly subject taxes and fees and other kinds of things that occur outside the permitting context to this heightened scrutiny. I think the dissent is wrong, that the majority got it right when it said, no, we're talking strictly about the permitting process and the very unique kind of coercion that takes place within that process. You're targeting a permit applicant for his property. It's occurring usually behind closed doors in the midst of quote-unquote negotiations. And so there's this heightened risk of coercion against a property owner that you're actually confiscating property that the government really is not entitled to. And it's in that scenario that this heightened review applies. In the case of taxes and fees, Those are typically imposed through the democratic process. They're generally applicable across the entire community. You have other kinds of checks and balances to ensure that these taxes and fees aren't confiscatory. So there's no reason to apply the rationale used in this case for land use permitting exactions to things that occur outside that process. And moreover, the court went out of its way, the majority did, of saying that, look, what we're talking about here is a financial obligation that burdens a very specific real property interest, and that is the land that Mr. Kuntz owned. So there's a very close connection there between the financial obligation and his right to use and develop his private property. You don't have that kind of connection in general with taxes and other kinds of things that occur outside the permitting process. So I think the sense sky will fall arguments really aren't going to hold any water in the long term. I'd also point to other jurisdictions in other states in the country that have already adopted this rule at the state level. In other words, some states like Texas and Illinois, I believe, is another one. They already recognize that monetary exactions that are imposed in the permitting process should be subject to nolen dolen review. And in those states, we haven't seen the kinds of things happen that the dissent predicts will happen across the country. So I think you could also look to past experience to dispel the kind of pessimism that the dissent expresses.
All right, we've got a number of folks waiting on the call. We're trying to get to all the questions. Let's go to our next caller.
Paul, congratulations on the victory. This is Matt McReynolds across town at Pacific Justice Institute. I have two questions for you, and I'll just ask one at a time to be less confusing. The first one relates to a situation that PLF had a few years ago with a road improvement type of fee down just below South Sacramento in my town of Elk Grove. And I don't recall quite what happened with that, but I'm wondering if that outcome maybe would illustrate some added dimensions to the Kuntz holding.
Yeah, in that case, that was a case that we handled on behalf of the Banzon family in Elk Grove, and they essentially wanted to build a home on their lot in Elk Grove, and the city of Elk Grove imposed an exorbitant monetary exaction for road improvements, lighting, all sorts of things, really, that went far beyond the impact of their project. And so we were making a proportionality argument. That case really does highlight, and the case actually settled and the fees were reduced substantially, I think from, I want to say, over $300,000, which was the cost of building the home itself, to maybe $10,000, I think it was. So it was substantially reduced back down to a proportional standard or proportional rate. But the case does illustrate the extent to which governments will go in order to target individual property owners to subsidize public projects, public improvements that benefit the entire community. This was a point that was made at the oral argument in January, in particular by the Chief Justice, that the Takings Clause is specifically designed to ensure that community benefits, public improvement projects and the like, are borne by the community as a whole that benefits from it. And that the purpose of the Takings Clause is to ensure that individual property owners aren't targeted, aren't singled out via confiscatory demands to bear the entire burden of providing these public services. And so governments have been doing this, Elk Grove, other governments across the country. Now, with this decision, with this heightened scrutiny standard that applies, we're going to see, I think, a serious reduction, if not elimination, in these kinds of mitigation, exorbitant mitigation fees.
I appreciate that explanation. My second question it has to do with church properties and church developments, which we are involved with in a number of places. In your thinking about the Kuntz decision and the implications of that, are you aware of or have you thought of any particular implications that might intersect with the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act?
I haven't, particularly not being an expert in that area of the law, I haven't considered what the implications might be. My immediate reaction is that because this involves exactions across the board, that religious institutions would be treated no differently in the course of a land use litigation challenge as any other property owner. the case Kuntz relied on the unconstitutional conditions doctrine to hold that all permit exactions that burden the takings clause rights should be subject to heightened scrutiny. I don't know that, you know, I don't know if that would apply any differently in the context of a religious property owner. So that remains to be seen.
All right. Thanks for your time today.
Sure.
Let's move on to our next caller.
Hi, Paul. This is Bill Severson out in Seattle. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Got a question, a follow-up. And it's the concern about how communities may now try and characterize these exactions as taxes rather than development fees. And I'm thinking particularly of the Washington Drabik decision you may know about. But I expect that's going to be the tactic, and we will get communities coming up with schedules of desired public improvements, and then those will be allocated out on some sort of a per development basis to new construction, and you'll come up with road fees and sewer fees and park fees and all that sort of thing on standardized schedules, and the communities will characterize those as excise taxes on the privilege of developing your property, and claim they're asserted as to be a tax and should be treated as a tax, and local governments and states have broad taxing authority. The only thing I saw in the opinion addressing that at all much was the statement that, you know, we find it easier to distinguish taxes from fees in practice rather than in theory, which gave me little comfort given Chief Justice Roberts' characterization of the Obamacare penalty as a tax. And I guess I wonder, could you comment on that? And do you think there's anything in the opinion that prevents governments from going down that road?
I recall a section of the majority opinion that makes the point that most jurisdictions, and I don't know if this is true in Washington or at the local level in Washington, but most jurisdictions have very well-defined rules and limitations as to what can be characterized as a tax. And so that if a local permitting agency, well, just as an example, I think it gave an example of the fact that permitting agencies typically aren't allowed by law in many jurisdictions to impose taxes. So if they're going to characterize what they're doing as a tax, they would already be doing something unlawful. And that the district in our case actually went out of its way for that very reason to say that what it was imposing on Mr. Kuntz was not a tax because it had no authority to impose taxes. And so it had to characterize what it was doing as a monetary exaction that allegedly mitigated for harm that Mr. Kuntz was causing. So I think there are rules and limitations in place in many jurisdictions. Again, I don't know in which ones, but I suspect that in most there are rules and limitations that say what a tax is and who has the authority to impose taxes, so that a local planner in most jurisdictions I don't believe has the authority to say, I am imposing a tax on this property owner. Or even if the city council or board of supervisors or the local governing board decides to pass a tax, there are certain requirements, prerequisites to how they do that and what they can characterize as a tax. And so I think there are limitations already in place that they'll have to characterize what they're doing as mitigation, and if it is mitigation, and even if they are able to impose what they characterize as a tax, we will have to argue that you have to look at the substance of the thing, not at the form. And it's evident that what they're doing is trying to mitigate, allegedly, against public harms caused by the development. And for mitigation, you have to show that there's a close connection between the impact and what's being required. So I think even if they get as far as saying, hey, this is a tax and that's lawful, we'll still be able to argue substance over form, that you look to the thing itself. What are they trying to do here? Are they trying to provide a general public benefit enjoyed by everyone and paid for by everyone, which is what a tax typically is? Or are they mitigating And if they're mitigating, they'd be subject to Nolan Dolan review. So I think there are a couple of ways that we'd be able to attack that. But I wouldn't be surprised, as you say, if some jurisdictions that have the authority to do so would try to just rename what they're doing as hacks. But again, I think courts will be able to see through that and analyze it as mitigation for what it is, mitigation, and then subject it to heightened scrutiny.
Once again, we're talking to Paul Beard. If you have a question, we have two questions in the queue. After that, our lines are open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski. I'm a lawyer in New York. I don't know if this question is a little too flip, but if the exaction, so to speak, is of a landowner's labor, wouldn't that also be a violation of the 13th Amendment against indentured servitude and slavery?
I have with others discussed that possibility in the past, and I think you're right. But I think it would be difficult for a court to swallow that argument. It is very novel, and I don't know that there. I have not researched the case law to see if the 13th Amendment has been applied outside the context of slavery or involuntary servitude, literally. So I don't know if that would actually work. But that idea has definitely come to mind, and I think you're right that it is in essence. That kind of thing. It's involuntary servitude. When you're forcing someone.
The involuntary servitude, and I believe it refers to indentured servants, which really is simply a contract for someone to provide labor without compensation for some other purpose, and it would almost squarely fall under the definition if the landowner entered into a contract with the regulatory body to get some other benefit that is separate from compensation.
Sure, and I think that interpretation is right. It just sometimes, not with respect to this argument in particular, but we're very careful about the kinds of arguments we present to the courts because they don't all view it like we do, the Constitution like we do, and so I don't know that would actually fly. But I definitely agree that there's purchase to that argument, and it's something that we'd be looking to in the next case that presents sort of an exaction of labor. Type situation as opposed to a direct monetary exaction.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
And congratulations again.
Let's take what looks for now to be our final question.
Hi, my name is Larry Joseph. I'm a lawyer in Washington, D.C. About specific regulatory – first of all, congratulations. Great work.
Thank you.
The specific kind of regulatory programs, I'm wondering if you have anything either in your pipeline generally about the Endangered Species Act and takings, or whether this in any way fits that form of regulatory taking.
Can you be more specific with respect to the Endangered Species Act? What kind of taking are you referring to?
Well, I mean, there's a gamut. I mean, if you've got to do stuff to mitigate your specific effect on the property, but there's other adjacent properties that are benefiting from your, you know, sticking your neck out to help the critter or whatever it is. That's very proportional, perhaps, and you alluded by analogy to that in the Nolan case. If the easement was just sort of shifted around on the property, that might be okay. On the other hand, it could be, you know, you can't build anything on your property because it's the whole property is covered by, you know, whatever critter or thing. I don't really have a specific narrowing.
I think to answer your question maybe generally, it would certainly apply in the case where the federal government seeks to impose mitigation requirements for disturbance of an endangered species. The court would, the federal agency would have to demonstrate an essential nexus and rough proportionality. In respect to the denial of a permit to build at all, because of an endangered species. Other types of regulatory takings cases, as you may know, would apply either the Lucas test if you've been denied all economically viable use, or the Penn Central case if you've been denied some use but are able to use other aspects of your property. So when we're talking about a total denial, for the benefit of those who may not know the takings area, when you're talking about a total denial of use, other cases come into play. This, the Nolan, Dolan, and now Kuntz case, are not attacks on your inability to use your property to whatever extent. It's an attack directly on a condition within a permit approval or one that leads to a permit denial. So you're attacking the condition, and you're attacking more specifically the burdening of your right to compensation when the government takes your property, in this case, money. So it's a very, very specific and narrow area of the law that applies in the land use permitting context, and it would apply again to the feds when they apply the ESA and require mitigation for harm done to endangered species. Certainly would apply in that case.
Great. Well, this is Dean Reuter again. A final call here for questions. If you have a question, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And we do have another question here, so we've got a few minutes left. Let's take this question.
Congrats on the nice victory. Very very much appreciated. The question has to do with potential end runs that the governmental agencies can take around this type of ruling. And in particular, the one I'm referring to is the use of changes in overall zoning to affect what would otherwise have been an equivalent condition. Given that real estate is often very unique, it's possible to make a zoning change which affects just one piece of property and could accomplish the same ends by different means. So I'd like to get your reaction on whether or not this ruling here would potentially cover that as well.
I think you're referring to spot zoning, which we've been involved in some litigation involving spot zoning, but I'm not an expert in that area, so I can't comment on the law with respect to spot zoning. But I'm not sure I understand how a spot zoning change would be, in essence, the equivalent, a way of the government to perform mitigation without having to go through Nolan and Dolan. Maybe if you could expand on what you have in mind, how that would be the case.
And this wouldn't be as much having to do with monetary fees, but would be having, for example, the Nolan Dolan easement, for example, might be an example of something that would be part of a zoned restriction rather than a condition.
And the zone restriction would take what form? It would say what exactly?
Public access easement, that type of thing.
Well, I think if I understand your question, if a legislative body passed a zoning law or regulation that suddenly declared, say, a quarter of your property to be a public access easement, and I think that's what you may have in mind, then I think what the government has done there is to that is sort of the classic regulatory taking, and you would challenge that as a taking without compensation. I'm not sure that because it doesn't occur within the permitting process, it's just sort of a unilateral declaration that suddenly your property is burdened by a public access easement. Because it's outside the permitting process, Nolan, Dolan, and Kuntz, I don't believe, would come into play. And because it would be a zoning law or regulation change. So in that case, I think you'd have to approach the taking differently. You'd have to appeal to other takings cases like Penn Central or Lucas or what have you, or any of another number of cases like Loretto, to say that this is a taking that the government has taken my property unilaterally, and therefore I want compensation. That's very different from Nolan, Dolan, and Kuntz, where we're not asking for compensation. These cases are prophylactic cases that seek to enjoin, to prevent a condition from being consummated. We're not asking for compensation in any of these cases, the Nolan, Dolan, or Kuntz case. We're asking instead for the court to strike the conditions down. That's a very different type of loosely regulatory taking than the other takings cases, like the one you're referring to, where the government simply comes in unilaterally outside permitting and says, we now own an easement in your property. If the government does that, you can challenge that as a taking without compensation, but I don't think you can challenge it in the context of Nolan, Dolan, and Kuntz. Those cases are reserved for a very particular circumstance, and that is when you're seeking a permit to build and they impose conditions and you're trying to strike down a condition. So I think the two are very, very different scenarios.
Thank you.
I hope I've answered your question.
We've got about 10 minutes left. It looks like we do have yet another question, so let's take another call.
Congratulations on the major victory. I'm Richard Faulkner, and I have a question relating to how you think the Kunz case may apply to the takings cases that are winding their way through the courts now on behalf of the terminated General Motors and Chrysler dealers, where the facts show that the government ordered those entities to terminate the dealers unnecessarily, and how it may also apply to the Star Enterprises case that's currently being pursued on behalf of the AIG shareholders.
I don't know that the Kunz case would directly apply because, as I said, it is a land use case, but I do think the rationale could provide some fodder for those who want to challenge those government actions, because what the court did in Kunz was simply reinforce the unconstitutional conditions doctrine and what is required to demonstrate a claim under the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, that you have to show that some property was given up forcefully in exchange for a benefit. Now, I don't know those other cases at all, actually. I've heard a little bit about them in the news, but I don't know enough about them to comment as to Kunz's specific application. But if there was some benefit that, say, General Motors was receiving, or even a right that it was entitled to, and that right or benefit was burdened by a demand that it give up property or a concession or an interest of some kind, specific interest of some kind, to which the government was not otherwise entitled, then I think Kunz could help in the sense that it does reaffirm the principle that unconstitutional conditions that heightened scrutiny needs to apply to these kinds of unconstitutional conditions. So it may provide some sort of collateral help, but I don't know that they'd be directly applicable.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Beard, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and giving us your insights, certainly an insider's account of what transpired and perhaps what's to be expected going forward in this area of the law. And several callers have congratulated you. I certainly join you in congratulating you and PLF for a string of important victories now, and wish you the best going forward. For our callers, a reminder to check our website, the Federalist Society's website, for a schedule of upcoming calls. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.